This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books Network. I'm your host, Schneur Zalman Neufeld. Today, we're going to explore a foundational work of modern sociology of religion written by Emile Durkheim, titled The Elementary Forms of Religious Life, and first published in French in 1912. I'm delighted to explore this book with my mentor and friend, Stephen Lukes. Professor Stephen Lukes earned a PhD from Oxford University. He went on to become a fellow in politics and sociology at Balliol College, Oxford. He was then in turn a professor of political and social theory at the European University Institute, Florence, and moral philosophy scholar at the University of Siena, and of sociology at the London School of Economics, following which he became a professor of sociology at New York University. He is now a professor emeritus at New York University. I'm so glad that we're able to have you on the program today.
It's such a pleasure to be here.
Oh, great. So to get started, could you please tell us a little bit about your background and what led you to study the work of Emile Durkheim?
Well, I'll do it briefly. I was a student. I was in England at Oxford University studying philosophy, politics, and economics. And I became very interested in social theory and was interested in writing about something to do maybe with Marxist theory. And my supervisor, my director of studies, suggested that instead of writing about Sorel, which I had thought about, he suggested, had I read any Durkheim? I went away and read Durkheim's first great book, The Division on the Division of Labor, and was somewhat impressed but not convinced. Then I read The Elementary Forms of the Religious Life, which we're going to discuss today, and it blew my mind. I was kind of astonished by this book because it was not only about very important fundamental philosophical questions, about the very fundamentals of how we know things, about knowledge, and it was about religion, and offered a very general theory of religion, and it just seemed to be about so many different things with such massive implications that I thought this was who I'd like to work on. And so I then did do that. I decided to do my doctorate on this great thinker. As it turned out, it was a very good idea, and I was also very fortunate that I then switched my supervisor to the great anthropologist, Edward Evans Pritchard, who was probably the greatest living social anthropologist at the time. And I worked under his supervision for the subsequent period when I wrote the thesis, the dissertation, which then became a book.
Right. And I have to say, I've known you now for many years, and we've discussed elementary forms a great deal. And I had no idea that it had such a profound role in your decision to take on the challenging work of studying Durkheim.
Yes, yes. That book made the difference, definitely.
Well, that's very propitious for our, and very appropriate for our discussion today. So before we get started with some of the details about Durkheim's life and his work, I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about what it means that a book like The Elementary Forms is considered a classic in the sociology. What does that mean that a book is a classic?
A classic? Well, there's lots of thinking about this, and I'm not sure I have anything to contribute, especially except to say, yeah, a classic is, of course, a text, let's say, or a whatever it is that survives. And why things survive, of course, there are lots of different reasons for it. I think in the case of a book like this in an intellectual field like sociology, it has to do with something that touches on big questions that people care about, that survives over time and keeps opening up new questions. I mean, often a classic is a text which will be subject to different interpretations. People will not agree about what its meaning is, except they'll agree that somehow it's important to disagree about it. And so people will have different views. And what I think about Durkheim, and in this book in particular maybe, is that it continues to be fresh in the sense that people keep asking new questions and finding interesting answers in it. So it's classic in the sense that it goes on interesting people by opening up new avenues of thinking.
Right, right. And it's certainly worth bearing that in mind as we talk about some of the claims that Durkheim makes in this book, claims which at the time or since then, scholars have come to challenge or even reject, and to realize that it still holds a place of prominence, as you say, because of how fruitful it is for intellectual inquiry, rather than that this is a work of sort of perfection or something, that every line or every central claim even in the book is somehow, you know, beyond reproach.
Very far from true in this case.
Right, right. So to jump in a bit, could you tell our listeners a little bit about who Emil Durkheim was and what was the social context in which he came of age?
Yeah, well, he was born in France in an area that was contested because it was, there was the Franco, there was the Franco-Prussian War. He was in Alsace-Lorraine, where the question of the defeat of the French, the defeat was important. The war was important because it raised questions about the very sources of social stability. And he was a very he was Jewish. His father was a rabbi. The whole family had been rabbis. I mean, the forebears of his father were rabbis, but going back for generations. And so he was brought up as an Orthodox Jew in this French city of Épinal, where he very early on dissociated himself from being an Orthodox believing Jew. Not that the question of it wasn't, as it were, an issue, particularly, except that there is a story that he was very much influenced by a Catholic schoolmistress, but I don't know about that, how true that is. But he then was very concerned to succeed in the French academic system. So he tried several times to get into the most elite institution, the École Normale Supérieure, as it was then regarded as and was then regarded as the pinnacle of intellectual success. And eventually he did get in and was educated there and became, in due course, a teacher, which was the French way. You became a school teacher and then eventually a professor, first at the University of Bordeaux, then eventually at the center of things in Paris. And he was very concerned to be a success as a Frenchman. And so he was, this involved him rather understating, not concealing, but not making a thing of being Jewish. He was very concerned to be accepted as a French intellectual, which he was. And except that, of course, there was an anti-Semitic atmosphere in France, especially during the time of the so-called Dreyfus Affair, which was a scandalous occurrence at the end of the 1890s, in which he took the side of defending this Captain Dreyfus, who had been accused, falsely accused, of betraying his country. And Durkheim was very much on the side of defending Dreyfus, along with the great French writer Émile Zola. I don't know if I'm going into too much detail here.
No, this is wonderful.
So Durkheim was, of course, it was known, well known, that Durkheim was Jewish. And so, though he never made a thing of it, and indeed, as the First World War drew near, the Great War of 1914, he was indeed quite publicly attacked as a Jew. But this didn't really signify much during his lifetime for him, except for the fact that he was a great defender of human rights. And that became clearest, most clear during the time of the Dreyfus Affair, when he was a founding member of the League for the Rights of Man in Bordeaux. And so the way to summarize all this is to say he was a great French professor who was much attacked during his lifetime for his writings and his thought, in particular about religion. There is something to say, perhaps we'll get onto it, about the relationship between his thoughts about religion and his Jewish background.
Right. Yes, I do want to come back to that maybe later on. But before that, so Durkheim wrote the elementary forms. He also wrote numerous other texts, major works that are considered, again, still considered landmarks in sociology today, as well as many, many other articles and publications. Are there distinct features to Durkheim's sociology?
Yes. His very first lecture, when he became professor at Bordeaux, in 1887, was called Social Solidarity. And that was his preoccupation throughout. How is it that our societies hold together? How is it that we aren't living in a chaos? What is it that binds and relates us to each other in ways that we don't even recognize? His work is basically, I think, a kind of exploration of that question all the way through. What are social bonds? How do we understand them? What is the way to make sense of the fact that societies hold together? How does that happen? So I would say that was, if you wanted one single overarching question, that very general question was it. And there's the background to this, you might say, goes all the way back to the French Revolution. I mean, when, of course, society seemed to many to fall apart, or at any rate, the question of what is it that can, account for and maintain social order became central. The social disruption of the French Revolution was the whole background to this. And Durkheim came at the in succession to, at the end of a whole succession of thinkers who had addressed this question. Another one earlier on had been Alexis de Tocqueville. And he, his answer was distinctive. That's what makes his sociology interesting. It was really about the question, what is society? How do individuals relate to society? What is it that binds people together into a society?
Right, right. And before Durkheim wrote The Elementary Forms, he wrote another book on suicide.
Yes.
And I think it might be useful to talk a little bit about that book, and especially what its basic approach is to religion.
Well, that might be his most famous book, or maybe, you know, along with the religion book, it certainly has survived as a classic in the sense that we talked about it earlier. So the book on suicide is indeed about this very question of how people, how social bonds work. And that book certainly has survived, is still read, is still disputed. It's very controversial. Much of Durkheim's writing is very polemical and controversial, as well as attempting to be scientific. And it was very scientific, that book, Suicide, in the sense that he used, for the first significant time by a sociologist, I'd say, statistics. I mean, that book is full of statistics. And for the time, pretty advanced statistics. He was very interested in suicide rates. Now, that book was, in a way, a remarkable, bold achievement. It was a kind of, the boldness of it is very striking. Why? Because what is suicide? Suicide is the act of killing yourself, you could say, is the most individual, private, intimate acts that anyone can commit. You're departing from society, you're leaving it, you're abandoning the social life. And you might think, people do think, mostly for very personal, intimate, individual reasons. Yet Durkheim thought, we can look at this sociologically. And by sociologically, he meant, and he was in the business, that was his project, to build up sociology as a discipline, as a professor at Bordeaux, where he there already was. And the point of this book was to say, look, I mean, implicitly to say, if we can explain suicide sociologically, the least promising, you might say, topic for a sociologist studying society to embark on, then that really is a mark that sociology is here to stay. So the idea was to look at not to look at individual cases specifically, but to look at suicide rates in order to account for the fact that they vary. And if you can give an account of that, Durkheim thought, you've given an account of the social conditions under which suicide happens. And so the book develops a very remarkable and interesting, though very questionable, account of the social conditions under which the suicide rate rises or falls. And so he noticed, for example, you don't want to go into this book in detail now, I presume, but for instance, the suicide rate rises in wartime. Why? Well, not surprisingly, maybe after what I've so far said, for Durkheim, that had to do with social solidarity, social cohesion. Under such condition, there is a pulling together. People come together to feel connected to each other. And there was similar, he had a similar sort of set of questions about crises, economic crises, for instance. What is it that explains how under social crises the suicide rate also rises? Sorry, I think I may have said something mistaken just now a moment ago. In the wartime, the suicide rate falls, of course. There is a pulling together of people because there is a sense of solidarity. It rises right. during times of economic crises.
Right, and so that alone is a kind of let's say a surprising finding, because you might think that during a war people are very depressed and therefore they might be more likely to commit suicide. And he found something counterintuitive, which is always what sociologists are looking for, something that's startling. And he found that actually the suicide rate goes down because even though people are going through a very difficult time, because of the difficult circumstances, they actually come together and support each other, right? And he also found something interesting specifically about religion, right? About the suicide rates in different countries, and he connected that to religion. What was that about?
Well, he did something very clever there as a scientist and a statistician. He wanted to figure out the effects of different religions on the suicide rate. He had the clever idea, Switzerland is interesting because there are Protestant cantons and Catholic cantons. And so we can look at, and also we can figure out where there are places where Catholicism predominates, Protestantism predominates, and even we can look at what happens with Jews. And he did find significant relationship between the suicide rate and the predominance of one or another religion. And so he reasoned from this, we can't go into the detail now, but basically the idea was some religions, and he had in particular Catholicism in mind, are particularly effective at generating social cohesion. And so under those conditions, he found a lower suicide rate than where he thought Protestantism, with its strong individualism, the strong idea of the individual lay believer being in a way responsible for his or her own life in very dramatic ways, that was had a kind of socially dissolving a kind of effect that he thought of as what he called anomic. Or even isolating. That's to say that individuals were thrown back on themselves. So this kind of connection between the doctrine and the effects on social solidarity was a preoccupation in this book.
Right, right. And speaking of religion, which scholars of religion influenced Durkheim's thinking on the subject?
Well, he had a kind of transformation of his interests, or kind of aha moment, you know, suddenly felt that he had found something new and important in the mid-1990s.
1890s.
Sorry, 1890s, yes, where he was very interested by a certain Protestant theologian writer called Robertson Smith, Scottish, who had found very interesting things in a book called The Religion of the Semites about the ways in which, according to Smith, the ancient Semites had united around communal meals, for example, eating together. He was very interested in the idea of collective rituals. And he found that in Smith, among other places, which inspired him to think about the ways in which religion brings people together and reinforces their social solidarity.
Right. And what was the basic evidence that Durkheim used to analyze religion in his book, The Elementary Forms of Religious Life?
Well, we'll come to that book now. So the thing is, what Durkheim did not do, which is what other great writers and sociological writers about religion did do, like, for instance, Max Weber, his contemporary, he didn't write about religion much. In that book, he didn't write about religion in his own time. He thought that, and this is very questionable, but not absurd, he thought, if we want to examine something so huge, important, world of such world historical importance as, let's say, religion, maybe what we should do is try and examine the problem, the question, from the in its most elementary forms. And by the way, the book, this is an interesting point, the book, which is called The Elementary Forms of Religious Life in English, in French, the title, the word elementary is translated as elementary, is élémentaire, which has two meanings, actually. It either means elementary or elemental. And in one sense, that ambiguity is important because in one sense, he's interested in the element, in seeing religion in its elemental form, that is to say, in its simplest version, that one could think of as having become aggregated and rendered ever more complex as society moved forward and became ever more advanced and complicated. And so he had the idea of looking at religion in what he thought of as its elemental forms, that's to say, in the form of small-scale societies that would be, on his assumption, the earliest societies where religion was born. So here he was making a kind of evolutionary assumption that the earliest societies were also the simplest and at the origins of the development of later religions. And that was very much a product of his time, that in which, you know, there was this idea of social evolution from the simple to the complex. And he thought of early societies as being the simple laboratory in which you could study religion at work.
Right. And where did he choose to study religion? In other words, what did he pick as his laboratory, as you say, to look at this quote unquote elementary or simple form of religion?
Right. Well, as you can see, a lot of this was going to be contested by later writers and anthropologists, especially the idea that any societies are simple, for instance. But nevertheless, he had this idea, which you can find really throughout the history of anthropology, that studying small-scale tribal societies tells you, gives you answers of general significance about human life and societies in general. And he looked for, of course, he couldn't examine the earliest societies way back in the mists of time, in the earliest stages of human development. But you could look at tribal societies in your own society, making the assumption that they will tell you something about how small-scale societies work. And so he relied in the book upon evidence. Now, remember, social anthropology, or the study of tribal societies, which is what it began as, was not yet really in place. There weren't yet any professional anthropologists. But there were increasingly many writings of people who visited such societies and studied them, missionaries and explorers and others who had written about such societies. And so he relied in particular upon studies of writings about Australian Aboriginal societies and what was then known from reports of Indian societies, Native Indian societies in the United States. And so these were the societies he used in some considerable detail based on these reports. In particular, there were two writers called Spencer and Gillen, who had written about Australia, in which he relies very heavily. And so a lot of the material in the book, the empirical material, is description of their rituals and their practices, especially their ritual practices, when organized around totemism, which was the prevailing form of mythical belief that was at work in such societies.
Right. And what did he believe? What did Durkheim argue was the basic nature of the system of totemism that was practiced in Australian Aboriginal societies?
Well, here is where it became very controversial to his readers. He was very struck by the fact that these societies would have practices, and in particular rituals, which involved the worship of, the treating of as sacred, the totem, which would very often be, let's say, an animal, or even a vegetable, or even something like something inert, like a stone, that there would be sacred beings that would be, you might think, quite common or garden or unremarkable, which would be treated as sacred and venerated and at the center of these rituals of many different kinds of rituals, all of which would take place with dancing and the use of ritual objects and other kinds of collective activity that would have the effect of bringing the members of the clan together in ritual activity. And that led him to think about, well, what is sacredness? What is this? What is the feature that renders this object of worship and sacrifice, because that was also part of the story, sacrifice as well as celebratory and funerary rituals as well, collective expressions of joy or grief or supplication to the gods. This would be or to the ancestors. This would be a focus of ritual activity that was treated as worthy of veneration and generating all kinds of emotions of both fear and extreme awe and admiration. These emotions, he thought of, were very much at the center of what sacredness is. So sacredness, and this was his striking thought, sacredness in these societies was oriented to these objects, these beings, I mean, like a vegetable or an animal that was treated as sacred. And his idea was, well, if that's what sacredness is, that tells you something about what religion is. Religion is about collective activity, binding people together in a community, in a social group, oriented towards the involving emotions, special emotions of awe and also fear, directed at that sacred entity. And the point of real difficulty here, or controversy, was in saying that about these tribal societies, which at that time were called primitive. We don't do that anymore when talking about other societies, but that was then the assumption. The idea that religion consists in venerating what is sacred, but in this case the sacred is plainly something common or God, or you know, their material in the world, and suggesting that that's what religion in general might be, he obviously, as you might imagine, raised serious worry among religious people of his own time who believed in God.
Right. So Catholic readers, let's say, in France, were horrified at the suggestion that at the heart of all religion was some kind of veneration of the sacred based on emotional attachments rather than based on the belief that there is an actual spiritual entity that exists in the world that they are in a relationship with.
Right. or not even in the world, outside the world, in a transcendent realm.
Right.
And this was indeed the problem, that one Catholic writer in criticism of Durkheim said, who would continue to pray to a being if he believed that, it was just an invention, a human invention? Who would do that? In other words, he saw Durkheim as challenging the very basis of spiritual belief by, for example, Catholics. Durkheim's response to this was, in a way, mischievous, I would say. He wasn't mischievous. He was a deeply serious person. And in a way, his response was a kind of, I don't know if mischievous is quite the right word, maybe ironic. He basically said, look, I'm a sociologist. Don't ask me theological questions. In other words, to the Catholic believer, he would say, I'm not challenging Catholicism. I'm offering a sociological account of what I have perceived in Australia and in North America. I'm giving you an account of the sacred so far as a sociologist can. And you could say that that was disingenuous, but I don't think it was, because in a sense, he also said something else. He claimed not to be engaged in, kind of dispelling illusions. He didn't, like Freud, think of religion as an illusion, at least in any straightforward sense. He didn't think, or like Marx, he didn't think that religion was just an ideology concealing human purposes. He even wrote more than once that all religions are true in their fashion. He respected religion. He thought that religion was a very, very important feature of social life, that was whose extraordinary persistence over millennia of human life had to be explained, and was of the view that if you just assumed that people were being misled by illusions by the powerful or by their own mistakes, as some writers at the time were arguing, you could never explain its persistence or its power. So he was very interested by now, by the time he'd written, started to think about this, in religion's power, in the way in which religion grips its believers, in which it offers them the idea of reviving their lives, rendering their lives meaningful, giving their lives a meaning. The whole idea, in other words, of religion as a transformative and animating and reanimating set of practices that makes life worth living. That was he was very aware of all that and wanted to make sense of it. And so he said both that all religions are true in their fashion and have to be understood as being extremely important and central to most people's lives, but also to offer an account of it which offended believers.
Right. So he really was in a kind of peculiar position, sort of politically, socially, at the time. And I think to a certain extent, even among contemporaries today, I think it's a rather distinct position that on the one hand, he recognizes the awesome power of religion to bring people together, to get people to do things that they might otherwise not want to do or not imagine that they could do. And at the same time, he essentially was saying, well, religion is a human construct, that this is not something that there's a spiritual being out there somewhere in this universe and transcendent being, whatever, that people are worshiping or being connected to. No, this is something that human beings have contrived, but at the same time, once it has been contrived, so to speak, it's something that could give them profound joy, profound strength, profound enrichment.
Well, we haven't yet reached what he actually had to say about what it was that could explain the veneration and preoccupation of religious believers with the sacred. What was it, after all, that explained all this apparatus, all this religious ritual that was so important and central to people's lives? I mean, he was very interested in as it were, the modern versions, the modern equivalents, you might say, of those rituals that he'd studied in Australia. I mean, we're all, you know, the Catholic Mass, whatever it might be, all the Jewish practices of, you know, ritual practices, they were all, in a way, to be understood as orientations to the sacred. So what was his account of what it is that's sacred? And his answer to this, which was very, in a way, not just challenging but provocative, but in a way outraged people, his answer was society. That in a sense, when people are worshipping their gods or their totems, they were essentially expressing in religious terms their connection with their society. And so it was really the social symbolism, or rather the social reverent of the symbolism of religion that he was focusing on. And this, in a way, remains a kind of challenge to the believer. I mentioned before that my study on Durkheim, when I did my dissertation on this thinker, was the great anthropologist Evans Pritchard. Now, Evans Pritchard became a Catholic, very believing Catholic, nonetheless deeply interested in Durkheim. And he once wrote that it was Durkheim, not the savage, meaning, you know, ironic term for the primitive, it was Durkheim, not the savage, who made society into a god. So that was Evans Pritchard's response to Durkheim's argument. In other words, nevertheless, he regarded the work as a work of genius and very important. I mean, as a challenge to a believer, it stands there as an alternative account, which, of course, if you're a Catholic, you don't accept.
Yeah, it reminds me a little bit that Evans Pritchard's response reminds me a little bit of something that Peter Berger, who is a devout Protestant, and who you know, decades later studied religion, and he basically said, when you think about the relationship between the sociology of religion or the social scientific understanding of religion versus the, you know, the religious, you know, the devout's perspective, he basically said, well, we don't know, you know, if when Moses went up, you know, the mountain, if he actually, you know, spoke to God or whatever. All sociologists could do is describe the physical setting of, you know, Moses going up the mountain and what Jewish people standing, you know, at Mount Sinai, how they responded and so on. We can't tell you, you know, whether or not he actually communed with God, but we could tell you he went up the mountain, then he came down, and this is how the society that, you know, that he was a part of responded to his claims of, you know, divine revelation.
Right. Well, I've just remembered, by the way, more precisely what the Catholic believer, Gustave Bellot, he was called, said in relation to Durkheim's argument. He said, who would continue to pray if he believed that all he was doing was addressing a collectivity that wasn't listening?
Right, right. So basically for Durkheim, if you think of, to put it in sort of contemporary terms, maybe if you think about a higher power, for Durkheim, the higher power was the collective, that when people were coming together for these very impassioned ceremonies, they were essentially celebrating and strengthening the social group, that was actually what they were venerating and what they were trying to strengthen.
Right. Well, now, but the way to think about that is, you say that's what they essentially were doing. And that might mean that's what they were really doing and they weren't doing the other thing. And when I said before, not entirely accurately, that he was being mischievous, he was being careful because he wanted to say, well, okay, that's what I can tell you. I'm a sociologist. Now, if you want to say that there's a truth there in the beliefs about the spiritual realm, about the transcendent realm, I'm not in a position to disagree with you. That's not my field. I'm not a theologian. You can do with that response what you wish. I mean, sometimes Durkheim seems to be saying, you know, what's really going on is what I'm telling you, and the other thing is illusion. And yet he goes out of his way to saying that he's not saying it's an illusion in the sense that it's false. This is a problem of interpretation. It's one of the things that makes this book a classic, I think, that this is never resolved by Durkheim. Religious believers, including Evans Pritchard, of course, but including also other believing sociologists who are Catholic or whatever, have found his work enormously important. I'm thinking of Mary Douglas, for instance, and Robert Bellar, who, and also probably Peter Berger, though I don't know what he thought about Durkheim. Peter Berger, by the way, was also Jewish by origin. I don't know if you knew that. So kind of interesting.
I did not know that. So I was told by a very Orthodox, my first sociology professor, actually, who is an Orthodox Jew, he told me that Peter Berger was, quote, a frum Protestant, frum being a Yiddish term for very religious. So he said that Peter Berger was a very religious Protestant, but I did not know that he had Jewish origins. But I think it's interesting what you're describing, you know, that, as you say, you could interpret Durkheim's words in several different ways, that he basically said, I'm giving you a social, scientific, a sociological explanation for how religion works. I'm not adjudicating, I'm not deciding whether or not God really exists, whether or not the faithful are really connecting to God. I'm telling you, here on earth, this is how things look, this is how things work. But as you note, it could be interpreted in multiple ways. You could say that he's being judicious, he's being circumspect, he's not making a judgment about theology, about the existence of God, he's kind of keeping in his lane as a social scientist. Or you could say that he's just being clever, and of course he didn't really believe that God exists, and he thought that was, you know, a ridiculous thing, but he didn't want to seem, socially provocative. And therefore, he claimed that he was just focusing on the observable facts of religion.
Right. There was a French mathematician called Laplace, much earlier on, at the time of Napoleon, who was similarly accused or thought to be an atheist or thought to be denying God. He was a mathematician. And his response to this accusation was to say, I have no need of that hypothesis.
Right. You mentioned early on that there were many challenges to Durkheim's elementary forms of religious life. Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about what some of those shortcomings were?
Well, I don't know if we want to go too much into detail here, because there is, of course, I mean, as I said before, between Durkheim and now, there is the massive accumulation of the ethnographic record of not just only of Australian Aboriginal societies, but also of North American Indian societies. And so, in a way, the basis on which he argued about tribes and clans and the information on which he was relying was very much of its time. But there is, it really is very interesting, and I hadn't mentioned this until now. He gathered around him a group of researchers, a group of colleagues, some of them students, some of them just colleagues, around a journal called the Année Sociologique, which published 12 volumes between 1898 and 1912. And these consist of masses of information as it was accumulating in those years, and including also monographs about, for instance, about sacrifice in early societies, in tribal societies, I'm sorry, and about magic. In other words, these topics are all very much related to religion. And so all of this material was very important subsequently, but above all, and this comes back to your question, not so much in terms of, you know, did he get it right about the this or that tribe or this or that clan, but more about the mechanisms he thought were at work, the sociological theory of account of the of ritual and the way in which it works and how it and its effects. And this is where the important lies, not in terms of the ethnographic detail. I do remember an anthropologist, Rodney Needham, once saying to me in Oxford when I was working on all this, that it could well be that every empirical proposition in Durkheim's book, Elementary Forms of Religious Life, is false. nevertheless, it remains a very great work of social theory, a social explanation. And that's I think, what I'd say about the connection with the actual ethnographic record. Though I have no doubt that the descriptions of ceremonies that he gleaned from, and indeed even the classification of the different rites, different rituals, was accurate enough, because I don't think anyone has suggested that Spencer and Gillen and the others were making things up.
Right, but maybe they didn't, as you know, Western outsiders in Aboriginal Australia or in Native American, you know, culture, they may have misunderstood, misinterpreted, misclassified, you know, some of the details of what they were observing.
Yes, of course, that issue of being an outsider, Western outsider, I mean, survives to this day. I mean, despite all the extremely advanced ethnographic, you know, techniques of ethnographic study, anthropologists are still outsiders, whatever you say. And so that remains to be a problem. It is interesting that Durkheim's great, one of his greatest collaborators, and indeed his nephew, Marcel Mauss, wrote a manual of ethnography, very much concerned with this issue of how you get inside the worldview of the society you're studying.
Yes, it's a very big problem. It's a very big problem. I found it in my own experience as someone who grew up in a very Orthodox Jewish background, and then ended up sort of leaving that community and then kind of turning back around, trying to analyze that very community, that there's all sorts of complications, because even if you were once a part of the community, if you have made the journey out, then you're not in quite the same status as someone who's still a part of it.
You're a semi-outsider.
Right, right. Well, semi-outsiders are not always so beloved by insiders.
Right, exactly.
So it could be a problem. But speaking of the people, researchers, sort of biographical you know, their upbringing and their social status. You touched on this a drop before, but I'm wondering if you could say a little more about what you think the relationship between Durkheim's Jewish background, very Jewish, even rabbinic background, many rabbis in his family tree, what's the relationship between that and his own understanding of religion in general?
This is a very interesting question, and in my book, and I've been criticized for this, I basically didn't touch it. And the reason I didn't touch it, there might be several. Being Jewish myself, maybe I was a bit nervous of touching it. But the main problem I had when writing that book was that there was no real evidence. But there is a very interesting young scholar at Princeton University called Taylor Winfield, who has written about this question. There is a certain amount of literature on it. And it's easy to say, you know, too simple things that are too simple-minded. But I do think, for one thing, the focus on social solidarity and the relative understressing of belief and theology is important. Durkheim grew up in a very cohesive, tightly bound together family. He was very conscious throughout his childhood of the rituals that of course they engaged in, and indeed was very good at keeping in touch with his family, and the whole, as it were, rabbinic world was was very familiar to him. He also, in his first book, The Division of Labor, there are a great number of references to the Pentateuch and to the literature of rabbinic discussions. In the Talmud, I mean, it's actually clear that he was deeply familiar with that whole world. And now, to what extent you can link that with the theory, I don't know. I hesitate even now to speculate. I think, as I say, there is some interesting literature on it, which people might want to look at if they're interested.
Absolutely. Well, there's so much more to talk about Durkheim and about one of his masterpieces, The Elementary Forms of Religious Life, but we have run out of time, so we're going to have to leave it there for today. Thank you so much for taking the time to share your thoughts with us.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
That concludes our program. Thanks for listening and have a great day.